It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. America has a long history of disenfranchising communities of color, and not just in the Deep South. We're even seeing it here in Wisconsin. Voter ID, mass registration purges, restrictions on who can help people register to vote, and gerrymandering are all symptoms we see in a lot of places in the United States, according to my guest. Do you live in an area that's subject to gerrymandering? Has that affected you? And if so, how? Do you feel like your vote matters? Why or why not? And are you able to vote, or have you struggled to meet ID requirements under Wisconsin's voter ID law? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University, and author of several books, including White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide. Her latest is One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol, good morning. Welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
You say that the disappearing minority voter is the 2016 presidential campaign's most misunderstood story. Why is that?
And I say that because after that 2016 election, I'm listening to the post-election analysis, and they were all saying, well, you know, African Americans just did not show up. They weren't filling Hillary. And it was all about the Hillary. And I'm sitting there shaking my head going, this was the first election in 50 years, first presidential election in 50 years without the protection of the Voting Rights Act. How do we miss the massive wave of voter suppression that went over half of the states in this nation and not put that into the calculus about what happened? Voter ID laws, closing polling stations, gerrymandering, reducing early voting hours, voter roll purges, all of those things combined to depress the black voter turnout. But it wasn't in the analysis, and it needed to be, because that is absolutely critical to the functioning of our democracy.
Well, lay out the numbers for us. Excuse me. How had voter turnout changed, especially for black, Hispanic, and Asian American voters between 2012 and 2016?
I think one of the most depressing numbers is that the black voter turnout dropped from 66% in 2012 to 59% in 2016, so a 7% drop. The import of that is that when you think about the very narrowed electoral college margins that Trump won, you know, he won the Electoral College by a total of 77,000 votes. That drop of 7% in the black voter turnout, given how strongly the black community is opposed to Trump's policies, that's seismic. That's a game changer right there. And we had less than half of Hispanics and Asian Americans turning out in the polls in the 2016 election.
So how many votes are we talking about when we talk about people being prevented from voting, being blocked from the polls? We talk percentages, but what are the numbers like?
The numbers, I mean, so we're looking at in terms of voter roll purges, for instance, the Brennan Center has calculated about 16 million people were purged from the voter rolls. That's seismic.
That 16 million people, that's a lot of people. This is happening, traditionally we assume that this kind of thing happens in the South, but that's really not the case anymore. In your book, you talk about this happening all over the place.
Yes, and, you know, we're seeing this massive spread, and frankly, particularly in states with Republican governors and Republican legislatures. It's that combination where we're seeing this massive spread of this array of voter suppression techniques. This is not to say that Democrats don't, for instance, gerrymander. Democrats do. But this array of closing polling stations, reducing early voting hours, purging voter rolls, requiring certain types of ID in order to be able to vote, that array is what we're seeing in basically Republican states. And those states are not just in the South, as you know. Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, those are all the kind of northern Midwestern states where we're also seeing this type of voter suppression activity.
Let's talk a little history here. I mean, this isn't the first time that black voters and other communities of color have been kept from the ballot box. How long has this kind of disenfranchisement been going on?
Oh, for far, far too long. I actually began to really track it with the Mississippi Plan of 1890. You know, as we know, after the Civil War, there was a very tumultuous period, and then in 1867, the Congress passed the Reconstruction Act, which provided for African American men, because women across the board could not vote until the 19th Amendment, which provided for African American men to vote. And then we get the 15th Amendment in 1870. And that constitutional amendment says that the right to vote shall not be abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. That opened up the franchise for African American men to vote. By 1890, we're getting to what we call the rise of Jim Crow. This is beginning to launch Jim Crow. And one of the key elements in the rise of Jim Crow was to disfranchise black voters. And so Mississippi figured out first how to do it. For Mississippi said, we've got to figure out how to say we don't want black people to vote without saying we don't want black people to vote, because then that would go against the strictures in the 15th Amendment. How do we get around the 15th Amendment and still get what we want? And what they did was to figure out what were the societally imposed characteristics for African Americans, and then use those as the litmus test in order to gain access to the ballot box. For example, black schools were chronically underfunded, chronically, systemically underfunded. And so literacy test became one of the mechanisms. And it was cloaked in the language of reasonableness. And all of these kinds of pieces we're going to see in the 21st century. And so it said, we really want people who vote to know what the laws are. To know what the guidelines are, what our constitutional foundations for the way that our society runs are.
Carol Anderson, I want to pick up that. I want to continue on this line, and then I want to hear how the Mississippi Plan spread and then how it grew into what we've seen here in the 21st century. Carol Anderson is a professor at Emory University and author of several books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In 2013, a Supreme Court decision known as the Shelby County ruling invalidated a key part of the Voting Rights Act. Our guest author joins us today to explore the history of voting rights and the after effects of the Shelby ruling. We're also going to be talking about gerrymandering, the rise of voter ID laws, and consider what's being done to both hinder and push for voter rights. We'd like you to join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email is ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Are you able to vote, or have you struggled to meet ID requirements under Wisconsin's voter ID law? Tell us what your experience is. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University and author of several books. The one under discussion this morning is One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. And by the way, Carol will be in Madison this Friday and Saturday. Friday night at 6:30, she'll be reading from her book and taking questions from the audience and signing copies at Shorewood Village Center. And then on Saturday, this coming Saturday, she will be part of the Wisconsin Book Festival and will speak at 7:30 Saturday evening at the Madison Public Library Central Branch. So I just wanted to mention those before I forgot. Carol, I'm sorry we had to kind of stop you in mid-thought there. We had a hard break to get to, but we were discussing the Mississippi plan and how that was implemented, cloaked in reasonableness. That language, it comes up again and again in your book to describe how a lot of these things, like the Mississippi plan, were put into practice.
Exactly. And so it seemed reasonable that you wanted people to be literate and to know what their constitutional foundations were. But when you don't provide funding for education, and in many places in the South, there were no high schools for African Americans. So then you're taking people who have a massively underfunded education, no high school whatsoever for education, and you're saying, read this section of the Constitution and interpret it to the liking of the registrar. Similarly, the poll tax, where it sounds reasonable. Democracy is expensive. Holding all of these elections are expensive. You got to have people who are there at the polling stations who are collecting the votes. You've got to have people who are counting, et cetera. So it feels only reasonable that people have a buy-in and that they pay a bit of a tax in order to have democracy function. Except when you have massive endemic poverty coming out of centuries of slavery and then sharecropping out of the Civil War, then asking people to pay who don't have money automatically creates this massive barrier to their right to vote. And the poll tax and the literacy test were very effective. By the time we're in 1940, only 3% of African American adults were registered to vote in the South.
Even if they could pay the poll tax, or even if they were able to somehow or other answer the questions, sometimes they couldn't even get somebody to handle their paperwork.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was, you know, I've got an example in the book of a man who was a coal miner in Alabama, and so he goes to register. And this is after World War II, and he goes to register, and the registrar wouldn't even acknowledge him. And finally, he's like, I want to vote. And so the registrar finally hands him the paper, and he's trying to do his literacy test. And the moment he's done, the registrar just crumbles it up and says, "You failed." There was the case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, where a man wanted to pay his poll tax, but the city clerk would not accept the payment. And because they wouldn't accept the payment, he couldn't vote because he had to pay his poll tax. And so he's like, "My right to vote has been violated by the state. I'm trying to pay my poll tax. They won't accept the money. What am I to do? I'm caught in the catch-22 here." Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court said, "Yeah, we don't see your right to vote being violated there." So one of the things that happens is that the reasonableness helps cloak the racist basis of these laws, so that the Supreme Court says that the 15th Amendment is not being violated by the poll tax or the literacy test.
We have had a caller, Jeff from Green Bay, who called in, and he had a comment. He says, the people who want to vote will find a way to vote, including people of color. Carol, you care to respond to what Jeff had to say?
Absolutely, because this is how the reasonableness piece works. So let me move up to voter ID, because that's where it sounds, again, very reasonable. And first we get the lie of massive rampant voter fraud, and it is a lie. It's not massive. It's not rampant. Greg Abbott in Texas could only point to two cases. When they passed their law in Indiana, they had zero cases. Chris Kobach couldn't find any cases. I mean, these are the folks who are the voting voter fraud champions, and they can't display anything looking like rampant to the courts. But what we say is that because we have massive rampant voter fraud, you need an ID to vote. Well, that sounds reasonable, except then these states craft the laws so that only certain types of ID are available, are eligible. And these legislatures, like the ones in North Carolina, have gone through the data to figure out what types of IDs African Americans disproportionately do not have, and then make those the IDs that make you eligible to vote. So, for instance, in Alabama said you need to have a government-issued photo ID, and then decided that public housing ID, which is government-issued photo ID, did not count. 71% of those in public housing in Alabama are African Americans. And for many, that's the only ID that they have. They don't have the driver's license because cars are expensive. The note, the gas, the insurance, etc. So disproportionately, African Americans do not have the driver's license. And so when Alabama said, public housing ID doesn't count, but your driver's license does, then the state shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles for fiscal reasons in the Black Belt counties. Now the nearest driver's license bureaus were 50 miles away. But if you don't drive and you don't have public transportation, how do you go 50 miles away to get the driver's license? One. Two, in poor areas, many people who are, say, 50 and above were not born in hospitals, so they don't have a birth certificate. Without the birth certificate, so for instance, in Indiana, you need a birth certificate to get the driver's license. But in order to get your birth certificate, you need a driver's license. So it looks simple. It's designed to look simple. It's designed to look as simple as a poll tax. It's designed to look as simple as a literacy test. But what these states have done is to create an obstacle. You need an ID, but only certain types of ID. And then they've created an obstacle to the obstacle. So to make it doubly difficult to be able to get the ID to vote. And again, the whole rationale for needing this ID is the lie of rampant voter fraud.
And married women need a copy of their marriage license if they changed their name when they got married in many of these states.
Yes. And so in Indiana, for instance, 60% of the people were turned away because they didn't have all of the documentation that they needed in order to get turned away from the Bureau of Motor Vehicles because they didn't have the documentation. And that particularly happens to women where you've got different last names and you're trying to get it all aligned up. Mm-hmm. And again, this is like make work for something that rampant voter fraud, many Americans believe that it happens because it's been said so many times in so many ways, but it's a myth.
We will continue this discussion with Carol Anderson about, the premise of the book, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. We want to hear from you. Do you think efforts like voter ID are a good thing? Why or why not? Are you concerned about what you hear about voter fraud? Does it exist? Does it not exist? Let us know what you think by calling 800-642-1234. Send us an email. The address is ideas@WPR.org, or you can mention at WPR Mornings on Twitter. My guest is Carol Anderson, professor at Emory University and author of several books, including One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. This Saturday, she will be in Madison as part of the Wisconsin Book Festival and will speak at 7:30 at the Madison Public Library Central Branch, Community Rooms 301 and 302. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're discussing the book, One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. Carol Anderson is a professor at Emory University and the author of that book. We want to hear from you. Are you able to vote, or have you struggled to meet ID requirements under Wisconsin's voter ID law? Are you upset about gerrymandering? Do you feel like your vote doesn't even count? Or are you fine with all of that? Let us know at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. Carol, we'll take a call from John in Muskego. John, good morning. You're on the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just have to make a comment on what your guest is saying, that there's no such thing as people, cheating or getting in a vote that shouldn't be theirs, that the massive voter, voter fraud doesn't happen. It does happen. It doesn't happen. It's your definition of massive is the key word here. It happens. It just doesn't go to the massive, in quotes, designation. So it's something that does happen. People have been caught in fraudulent votes, and it just seems like you guys are pulling strings, having to pull all these instances of bad things that happened 70-plus years ago to justify your reasoning. This is 2018. Stop pulling up stuff from the past to try to validate yourself.
John, thanks for the thought. Carol Anderson?
And one of the beauties of history is that you begin to see the rhythms and the rhymes. The word massive is not our word. The word massive is the word that has been used by those who are saying there is massive, rampant voter fraud. People like U.S. Senator Kit Bond, that was the word he used in 2000. That was the word, rampant was the word that Greg Abbott, who is now the governor of Texas, used in 2014. That is the word that Chris Kobach used in 2017. So that word massive is the word that is used to justify this spread of voter ID law. And it does happen. It is not massive. Justin Levitt, who is a law professor in California, looked at voter impersonation fraud, which is the only kind of voter fraud that IDs can catch. And from 2000 to 2014, he found that in a billion votes, that's with a B, that there were 31 cases nationwide out of 1 billion, which is like 0.00000000. already have laws on the books to catch that. So the need for voter ID is not driven by massive, rampant voter fraud. I mean, so you have President Trump talking about we had 3 to 5 million people voting illegally. We have massive, rampant voter fraud. So this isn't pulling up stuff from 70 years ago. This is what we're dealing with right now. And those IDs, the way that the laws are written, so you have the Fourth Circuit looking at North Carolina and saying you have targeted African Americans with nearly surgical precision. So this is what we're dealing with right now, and we have to ask ourselves, are we comfortable with the systematic denial of voting rights for American citizens?
That is the essential question here. How comfortable are we with having laws that deny people the right to vote in the hope that we might prevent one or two people from voting illegally? That seems to be, that's the premise here, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So let's turn to the. I want to make sure there's so much to get to here. We could easily. This is another one of those topics we could do several hours on. We only have the one. So I'd like to get to the Voting Rights Act. What was the Voting Rights Act originally designed to achieve?
What it was designed to achieve was to go after the massive disfranchisement that was happening in the South, particularly. For African Americans. Prior to that time, there had been attempts at trying to break open this really oppressive system, particularly in the right to vote. But it required massive litigation where somebody would have their voting rights violated, they'd have to sue, they would spend years in court, and that whole litigation way was not working. States would just tweak their laws a bit and then continue to disfranchise black voters. So we had numerous counties in the South that had large percentages of African American age-eligible African-Americans, but 0 to 1 who were registered to vote because of the voter suppression techniques that were used there. The Voting Rights Act said, okay, enough of this. We're going to have states that have a history of violating, discriminating against their citizens in the right to vote. And the way we're going to identify that is that fewer than 50% of age-eligible adults in that city, in that state, are registered to vote, and that they use one of those devices coming out of the Mississippi plan. With that, then, any of those areas that met that criteria then had to have all of their changes to their voting laws approved by the U.S. Department of Justice. That's called preclearance. Preclearance actually worked. You saw, for instance, in Mississippi, where the percentage of African Americans that were registered to vote in early 1960 were in the single digits, and by the time we're like in 1967, 68, it's almost 60% are registered to vote. Pre-clearance worked. The Supreme Court in 2013 gutted pre-clearance out of the Voting Rights Act in the Shelby County v. Holder decision, and that is what let loose this wave of voter suppression, particularly in those preclearance states.
So the status of the Voting Rights Act today, after the Shelby County ruling, is there any pending action in Congress to fix the things that the court said were wrong with the Voting Rights Act? Have we done that?
That legislation is stalled in Congress. The Republicans have not moved it through, and they haven't moved it through because, and I've got to go back to Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich is the head of ALEC, which was the organization that helped draft a lot of these voter suppression laws, then spread them throughout state legislatures. And he's also one of the founders of the Heritage Foundation. And he basically provided the blueprint. And his blueprint was, we don't want everybody to vote. Frankly, our leverage goes up as the voting population goes down. And that blueprint of restricting the vote, depressing, demoralizing the electorate so that fewer and fewer people actually vote is the formula for enhanced Republican power. And so we have a Republican-controlled Congress. And so legislation for the Voting Rights Act is actually stalled in Congress.
Let's take a phone call here. John is with us from Eau Claire. John, good morning.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So I am a social studies teacher here in Eau Claire, and I am a recent graduate. Part of my studies here at Eau Claire included a lot of work in the archives. And one of the interesting things I found in there kind of relates to what your guest was saying about the literacy test in the South. So I stumbled across a bin that was just filled with rejection justifications for people registering to vote in the South after taking their literacy test. And one that stood out to me the most was that there was one that simply said, applicant said it is rather than it was. And that was their reasoning for denying that person their right to vote. So this idea of hiding behind rational sounding ideas is definitely true. We have all sorts of evidence of that. So I just wanted to call in and share that a little bit.
John, thanks for the call. Carol Anderson?
Yes, thank you. It is mind-boggling. A man that I know who grew up in the Jim Crow South said he tried to register to vote. And the question that he got as he's going through his literacy test, and they're looking at him, and they said, okay, so how far is up? And he went, excuse me? They're like, how far is up? And they're like, you didn't answer the question. Registration denied.
It's like asking how often is often.
Exactly. In Mississippi, one of the questions was, how many bubbles in a bar of soap?
Amazing.
Yeah.
We're talking with Carol Anderson about disenfranchisement. She's the author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. We have a lot of callers on, but there's probably still room for you if you call right away, or better yet, send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. We'll try and get to as many of your phone calls as we can. We still want to talk a bit about, we haven't touched on gerrymandering yet. Like to hear if you live in an area that's been subject to gerrymandering, how has that affected you? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. And the Twitter handle is @WPRMornings. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show, and this is on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're having a conversation with Carol Anderson, the author of One Person, One Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. And with lots of callers who want to join us today, let's go back to the phones and hear from Joe, who's calling us from Waukesha. Joe, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Regarding voter suppression, we've reached a point, I think, in this state where probably no matter, if you are a Democrat, if you have want an alternative to Walker, there's no way you're probably going to have your vote respected because of essentially through gerrymandering. You know, we have, for all practical purposes, voter suppression in the state of Wisconsin. And how that's going to stop, I don't know. Wisconsin Supreme Court, I'm assuming, refused to take the case, whereas in Pennsylvania recently, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided to redistrict the state. therefore, Pennsylvania may have, more balance in their voting this you know, next month. Whereas we were apparently just thrown out of the Supreme Court. We weren't even considered. And I think it's quite frightening. I mean, it's another indication of voter suppression.
Joe, thanks for your call. Gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering, is kind of a big deal these days. Talk about Wisconsin's role here, which you covered in your book.
Yes, Wisconsin. So what happened in Wisconsin is after the 2010 election, a small group of Republicans basically sequestered themselves away to redraw the district maps. And that redrawing is actually constitutionally required after the census, so that population shifts are reflected in the kind of political landscape for Congress and the legislature. So they sequestered themselves. They had a powerful computer software, mapping software, and they had the kind of data about the kinds of proclivities that people had and where they lived. And they started drawing the maps, and they had two goals. One was to eliminate as many competitive districts as possible, because when you eliminate competitive districts, voter turnout goes down because it's like it doesn't matter if I vote. The second thing that the second goal that they had was that regardless of how many votes the Republicans received, they would always have the majority of seats in the legislature. So, and that kind of flips how we understand democracy on its head, but regardless, the Republicans would always have the majority of the seats. They would always have the majority of the political power. And the maps worked better than they thought. In the 2012 election, Democrats received 52% of the vote and gained 39% of the seats in the state legislature. And it was worse with each subsequent election. What the Supreme Court ruled was that they didn't believe that the plaintiffs actually had standing, because they were in a county that they weren't sure whether gerrymandering had actually affected them or not. Mm-hmm. And so that was the very fine line ruling, is do these folks have the right to sue? So it ignored the big question, and it ignored the incredible evidence about extreme partisan gerrymandering, how it undermines the constitutional principle of one person, one vote. And they ignored the incredible social science programs that had been, formulas that had been developed to determine whether we were looking at extreme partisan gerrymandering or just gerrymandering. And that's where the case stands.
And they're resubmitting it with more plaintiffs this time. Carol, we're almost out of time. Gosh, the clock has just rushed by. How are people pushing back? We've got less than a minute here, but give an example of how people are pushing back against all this.
So one of the big pushbacks you're seeing in Michigan, where a ballot initiative, a citizen-driven ballot initiative, is now on the November ballot to have a nonpartisan redistricting commission, in fact, handle the redistricting because of the way that gerrymandering silences the votes. It dilutes the votes of the American people.
Okay. Carol Anderson, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Chandler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University, author of One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. The Affordable Care Act has featured prominent. The Affordable Care Act has featured prominently in previous elections and worked in Republicans' favor. Now Democrats are trying to turn the tables, campaigning on a piece of the law that the public has embraced. In the first of a three-part story, Shemaine Mills reports.
Promises to repeal the Affordable Care Act helped propel Republicans into office in 2010. Unable to do so in Congress, they're again attacking the law by way of the courts. Wisconsin is one of the lead states in a lawsuit that argues most of the ACA should be scrapped because Congress got rid of the penalty for not having insurance when they passed the GOP tax cut bill. The federal lawsuit hinges on the individual mandate, the requirement that everyone have insurance. It's the least popular part of the ACA, also known as Obamacare.
Personally, I don't think the government should mandate that. That's none of their business. What if I don't want to buy it? And I'm not partaking in the benefits of it.
That's Robert Zettel. The 54-year-old Madison resident describes himself as conservative. Even liberals like 23-year-old Zach Young of Fredonia understand why the requirement to have insurance rubs some the wrong way. But Young says there's a reason for it.
I would also not get insurance if I had that option. However, if you stop requiring people to get insurance, it prevents the pool of money from being there to help everyone else.
People may not like the mandate, but they do like other parts of the law. A recent poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation shows 50% approve of Obamacare overall. That rises to 75% when people are asked about the law's protections for people with pre-existing medical conditions. An estimated 1 in 4 Wisconsinites have such conditions that are covered by the ACA, according to Kaiser. The GOP lawsuit would get rid of those safeguards, and it's a point Democrats are trying to drive home.
If Scott Walker takes away the protections for pre-existing conditions, I won't be able to afford the treatments that are saving my life.
As a nurse and a cancer survivor, I just cannot support Leah Vukmir.
Governor Scott Walker has pushed back, pointing out he supports a bill that would cover pre-existing conditions at the state level. But the bill would still let insurance companies impose lifetime caps on coverage. And it never passed. And it was Walker who gave the go-ahead for Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel's lawsuit to overturn the ACA. Democratic Attorney General hopeful Josh Call is trying to use that against Schimmel.
The state is arguing, Brad Schimmel is arguing that we should be striking down protections for people with pre-existing conditions, getting rid of the guarantee that young adults can stay in their parents' health insurance coverage.
But Schimmel says Obamacare is unconstitutional and didn't do what it promised.
We want this power to go back to the state of Wisconsin, to let legislators and leadership in Wisconsin determine what works best for Wisconsin.
Schimmel and other Republicans who support the lawsuit contend there are better ways to run a health care system, and they're hoping voters see it that way, too. But Republicans in Washington weren't able to muster the votes to pass a health plan replacing Obamacare, in large part because of a public backlash over their plan's lack of protections for pre-existing conditions. Speaking at a state Democratic convention in June, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin told party activists they won that fight.
You own that defeat of that cynical bill. Know your power. That was you. And that's what it's going to take to win this next election.
It's a contest where the political parties find themselves fighting over a familiar issue. Only the ground may have shifted since the last election. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The conversation continues here tomorrow at this time when Shemaine explains another way health care factors into the election. You can learn about all our upcoming election specials and follow election news at WPR.org. And Wisconsin Attorney General candidates Brad Schimmel and Josh Call debate for the first time this Friday night at 7:30. WPR brings you the debate live, moderated by Wisconsin Public Television's Frederica Freiberg and WPR's Sean Johnson. Ahead of the debate, join us for a special that looks at the Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senate. That airs Friday night at 7, followed by the debate at 7:30. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.